your brother Vladimir Diesel Ogaya, and welcome to the Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I started this show in 2011, my goal was to inform. Obviously, the show has evolved, a lot of new topics, a lot of new thoughts, taking on metaphysics, some spirituality, hitting you with all types of things that you may have never heard of, and some that you have. It's always lively. But now I'm coming to you to ask you to help me prolong this podcast. For years, I have been producing this podcast for free on your behalf. I am now coming to you to ask you to support this work. $2, $5, $10, $20, $50, whatever you can do, please do.
And now,
the definition.
The 1960s were in many ways the summit of our civilization. We had beaten polio, smallpox, and plague. Surely cancer and the rest of the world would succumb in due course. We had beaten the Nazis. Surely the commies were next to go. Social problems like poverty, racism, illiteracy, crime, and mental illness would be engineered out of existence. Everything pointed to unlimited growth and continued triumph. Atomic power, robots, space, artificial intelligence, maybe even immortality. But in the words of Patrick Farley, the future has been running a little behind schedule. Hints that technology was not the vehicle of utopia began to emerge early in the Industrial Revolution, but its successes were so spectacular that it was easy to believe that social and environmental problems were merely temporary impediments, engineering challenges we would overcome through the same methods, mindsets, and techniques that had solved previous problems. More technology, more control. Today, the successes are less spectacular, the crises harder to deny, the promise of utopia just around the corner more hollow, but we still act as though more control were the answer. For example, the medical establishment is having more and more trouble hiding the fact that, with the sole exception of emergency medicine, 40 years of, quote, advances have had little impact on human health and mortality. Consider the overall effect of the successes. Organ transplants were a real breakthrough, but their effect is limited to a few thousand patients annually. Most of the new pharmaceuticals merely control symptoms, often with severe side effects. Hormone replacement therapy is turning out to be a disaster. The same for cholesterol-lowering medication, antidepressants, and many of the painkillers. When a new medicine is unveiled, a, quote, 20% improvement in outcomes among a significant group of patients, close quote, is considered a great success. Despite decades of huge investment, it appears that the age of dramatic cures is over. There has been no cure for any of the poster child diseases, such as muscular dystrophy and breast cancer. Certainly no major disease has been wiped out since we conquered the great killers of the 19th century. Coronary artery disease has retreated little, if at all, in 30 years. Cancer is doing just fine, thank you. Arthritis is just as devastating as ever. Strokes nearly as common. Alzheimer's disease on the rise. Meanwhile, a host of formerly uncommon conditions, for which conventional medicine can offer palliative remedies at best, have grown into epidemics. Diabetes, autism, allergies, multiple sclerosis, lupus, obesity, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, multiple chemical sensitivities, inflammatory bowel syndrome, chronic fungal infections, and many others. Not only have formerly rare diseases become epidemic, but entirely new diseases such as AIDS have appeared seemingly out of nowhere. Finally, to add insult to injury, some of the conquered diseases of the past, such as tuberculosis, seem to be making a comeback, usually due to antibiotic resistance. This state of affairs constitutes a great unspoken crisis in medicine. Despite unprecedented billions of dollars in pharmaceutical research, medicine seems to be losing ground in the battle against disease. Typically, the response is more technology, more precise control at the genetic and molecular level, a continued search for the cure. Life expectancy has similarly failed to live up to predictions. For half a century now, futurists have been predicting dramatic increases in life expectancy. There is no reason why 120 years shouldn't be common. Perhaps with gene therapy, this could be extended indefinitely. A glance at the statistics, however, shows the most dramatic gains in life expectancy all occurred in the first half of the 20th century, not since 1970. From 1900 to 1950, life expectancy at birth rose by an impressive 21 years. Since then, it has risen only 9 years. Moreover, much of this improvement must be due to lower infant mortality and emergency life-saving procedures. Because if we look at the life expectancy at age 65, we find a paltry 4-year increase over the past half century. Gains in life expectancy show the same familiar pattern of diminishing marginal returns that we see in the agricultural application of fertilizer. The first application of technology, fertilizer, brings dramatic results, but subsequent applications have less and less benefit until enormous amounts are eventually required to boost yields a tiny bit, or even to prevent yields from falling. As burgeoning healthcare expenditures demonstrate, we are presently pouring enormous technological effort into healthcare with only tiny gains compared to the dramatic improvements that accompanied the comparatively modest expenditures of the early 20th century. We can expect that unless the fundamental direction of medical technology changes, life expectancy will stagnate and probably even begin to fall within 10 years. Nor has technology lived up to its promise to usher in an age of leisure. In the United States, leisure time did seem to be increasing throughout the 20th century until about 1973, when it began a gradual, sustained decline. Most researchers agree that leisure time has decreased in the 30 years since then. We are spending more time working, more time commuting, more time running errands, more time meeting the obligations of life. The computer, trumpeted as the final key technology that would do for the drudgery of mental labor what machines had supposedly done for physical labor, has brought about the opposite. More time spent in offices, at desks, at keyboards. By now it is apparent that the computer has not eliminated the drudgery of office work any more than the steam engine eliminated the ordeal of physical labor. Despite the information revolution, few people would argue that office work has become more intellectually stimulating and meaningful in the last 30 years. The solution? Again, it is more technology, more labor-saving devices, greater efficiency, better time management. Technology has similarly failed to bring about a world of plenty. While the food supply has indeed grown enough to feed a doubled world population, hunger and famine are no less prevalent, and for the same old political and environmental reasons, war, repression, and drought. Moreover, vast areas of land that were once agriculturally productive have turned to desert, so that we face the prospect of a food crisis, not a cornucopia. At the present writing, world grain stocks are in decline, and most of the great fisheries nearly depleted. The last 40 years of, quote, development in the third world have not brought the promised prosperity. To the contrary, the gap between rich and poor has widened globally and within third world countries themselves. Travel in the third world and you can easily see for yourself that destitution, disease, and dislocation of our own industrial revolution are still common today. And the justification is the same, too. It's just a temporary phase before you become a developed nation like us. We had to go through it, and so do you. It is the natural order of things. The prescription, then, is again more of the same further advances in agriculture and more vigorous economic development. Now, people around the world are starting to disbelieve this dogma simply because the decline in third world living standards has continued unabated for too long. That wasn't supposed to happen. In many Latin American countries, the middle class has almost disappeared altogether.
Hi, I'm Stan Muller. This is Crash Course, and today we begin our mini-series on intellectual property. Hey, isn't the entire concept of intellectual property illegitimate? I mean, how can we justify locking up the world's science and art so that corporations, publishing houses, and other gatekeepers can control what we know and what we think? Information wants to be free, man. Hey, me from the past! There's a Stan from the past! This is great! Anyway, I can tell by looking into your vacant and bloodshot eyes that you've been up all night downloading Chumbawamba records over a dial-up connection. I remember those days, and I remember you desperately trying to cling to any ethos that justified your rampant copyright infringement. That is, if you ever participated in such activities. And even if you had participated in said infringing activities, the statute of limitations is likely run out. I don't even know what LimeWire is. I like how this is getting started, because Stan from the past raises some interesting points. There's a good chance that he and a lot of you watching this video might think about aspects of intellectual property as outdated and pretty much irrelevant. Maybe lots of you don't think of it at all. That line, information wants to be free, has been used to argue that current intellectual property laws are outdated, overbroad, and generally awful. The quotation is attributed to Stuart Brand, and he said this to a group of computer programmers in 1984. On the one hand, information wants to be expensive because it's so valuable. The right information in the right place just changes your life. On the other hand, information wants to be free because the cost of getting it out is getting lower and lower all the time. So you have these two fighting against each other. The full quote, which you hardly ever hear, actually spells out the major tension between intellectual property and technology quite well. And it did it more than 30 years ago, when the digital age was just beginning. As information technology becomes more and more pervasive and important in our day-to-day lives in the information society, information itself becomes exponentially more important and more valuable. Paradoxically, as our information technology improves, and as our computers and connections get better and faster, and sharing becomes easier, we're less able to control the copying and dissemination of this incredibly valuable information. The law of supply and demand pushes down the information's value. This tension is nothing new. Technology, especially in the context of copyright law, has always presented challenges. Socrates, in Plato's Phaedrus, bemoaned the advent of books, arguing that they will implant forgetfulness in human beings' souls. They will cease to exercise memory because they rely on that which is written, calling things to remembrance no longer from within themselves, but by means of external marks. One way that humans have attempted to deal with these new technologies, with varying success, is by passing laws. The scourge of the piano roll was contemplated in the 1909 Copyright Act, the photocopier in 1976, and the internet was covered in the 1998 Digital Millennium Copyright Act. But we're going to try to avoid the simplified intellectual property versus technology binary. The idea that we have to choose between devaluing the fruits of intellectual talent and labor or devaluing the revolutionary information-sharing capacity of our networks is wrong-headed. The more interesting and more difficult question is how we can strike a balance, how we can incentivize and promote this revolution in the way we share information, while at the same time incentivizing and promoting the production of creative works and inventions by having respect for the human beings that actually created them. The difference between today's debates and those that took place 100 years ago is that intellectual property pervades our lives more and more every day. This is especially true for anyone viewing this video. I know that about 90% of you view Crash Course in a web browser, so consider the layers of IP in this very YouTube page. A lot of what you're looking at is covered by copyright. This video, for example, is covered as a motion picture work. The website itself is considered a literary work. The thought bubble, the theme song, and the video you watched right before this one all have copyright protection. The software that streams the video is also a literary work. The web browser you're using is most likely registered as a computer program, as is the operating system. Lest you Linux weirdos think that you don't have a copyright on your OS, you do. You're just not enforcing it. Even your comments could be covered by copyright. That haiku you just posted, who is this person? What happened to Mr. Green? Dislike. Unsubscribe. That's copyrightable. When you agreed to this, you granted YouTube a worldwide, perpetual, non-exclusive license to use your content in any way they see fit. There are also patents in play here. There's proprietary video streaming technology, and many of the components in your computer are patented. But wait, there's more! YouTube is a registered trademark, and if you saw an ad before this video, there was most likely a trademark in there. This is a trademark, and under this sticker is an image of a piece of fruit, also a trademark. And behind the camera, our most precious and valuable mark, Mark Olson. Mark Olson, everybody. The search algorithm that got you here? That's a trade secret. My appearance in this video and subsequent marketing of commemorative mugs with my likeness fixed on each one, that implicates my right of publicity. If you're watching this on an iPhone or an Android, there's a whole other world of copyrights and patents that apply. When you start to deconstruct it like this, it's dizzying. But despite all this complexity, most of the time the system moves along with a fluidity that sometimes makes it easy to put it out of your mind, kind of like the internal functioning of your digestive tract. But it's there. Always there, gurgling and churning and
functioning?
Did anybody order lunch? Now, much of this fluidity and seamlessness is born on the back of hundreds or thousands of lawsuits, many of them against Google, thousands of pages of intricately complex contracts, and hundreds of millions of takedown notices. The point is that none of us, or very few of us, can go about our daily lives without being impacted by intellectual property. It's only when it hits home, like when you receive a cease and desist letter from a trademark attorney for opening a restaurant called Burger Queen, or digital rights management software stops you from listening to your iTunes downloads on your Zune, maybe your YouTube video gets taken down because of that T-Swizzy song in the background. That's what the kids call Taylor Swift. Maybe you get a letter from your internet service provider informing you that someone using your account has downloaded every episode of Game of Thrones, and that if it keeps up, you may be fined or imprisoned or beheaded. That's when it flares up. Flare up? God, are we still on the digestive tract metaphor? Somebody get me a Tums. Tums, by the way, a registered trademark of the GlaxoSmithKline group of companies. Most of us encounter IP only on its borders. We hear horror stories about the motion picture and recording industries suing grandmothers. We watch those unskippable FBI messages warning us about the consequences of copyright infringement, or we complain about paying thousands of dollars per pill for medicine. We tend to encounter intellectual property law in places where we, as users, are basically being told no. And being told no over and over again is irritating, especially when these no's don't seem to make any sense. And are really irritating when they come with threats of fines or imprisonment. So in this course, we're going to focus less on enforcement and the no's, and more on the part of intellectual property that often says yes, sometimes, maybe, it is certain, or even ask again later. I'm speaking, of course, of the liquid-filled dye agitator containing a dye having raised indicia on the facets thereof, registered as patent US3119621, which you might know as the Magic 8-Ball. Before we get too far, we should probably define intellectual property. This is going to get pretty abstract, so let's go to the thought bubble. The theoretical definition of intellectual property would begin by saying that it is non-physical property that stems from, is identified as, and whose value is based on an idea or some ideas. There has to be some element of novelty. The thing that we describe as intellectual property can't be commonplace or generally known in the society where it's created at the time that it becomes property. You can't claim that you invented the wheel or that you wrote Moby Dick. Even though the source material for all IP is social, the inputs are our education, our human interactions, and basically all the sensory data around us that we take in, the thing that we call IP is the product of us putting together all these social inputs into something that we're going to call the idea. Only the concrete, tangible, or physical embodiments of the idea are protected by intellectual property law. The idea has to be fixed into a form and location in which humans have access to it. That could be a novel, or a logo, or a liquid-filled dye agitator containing a dye having raised indicia on the facets thereof. Thanks, Thought Bubble. So, in its purest and best form, IP is the propertization of intellectual effort and talent. In its most corrupt and worst form, intellectual property can be and has been used by the propertied and powerful to protect concentrated markets and broken business models. At its very worst, it can be used as a censorship tool. Intellectual property differs somewhat from real property like cars or houses because it's limited in duration and scope. For example, copyrights last for the life of the author plus 70 years. Copyrighted works can be copied under the fair use exception for certain personal or publicly beneficial uses. Let's say a book reviewer quotes long passages of a novel, then pans the book. It's likely the author of the book wouldn't grant permission for this type of use. But we want to encourage informed public discourse, so there's a good chance it would be found to be a fair use. Patent law has carved out a limited experimental use exception that permits minimal use of a patent for amusement, to satisfy idle curiosity, or for strictly philosophical inquiry. Again, the patent owner probably wouldn't like this, but the law wants to encourage individual tinkering. Both these limitations exist to serve the primary objective of intellectual property. That's to promote the progress of science and useful arts by increasing our stock of knowledge. So in this series, we're going to focus on the three main branches of intellectual property. Copyrights, patents, and trademarks. We won't have time to get into some of the lesser cousins of the family like trade secrets or the right of publicity, but all of these are included under the umbrella of intellectual property. So in the coming weeks, we're going to try to get at some of the nuts and bolts of what intellectual property is. Because like it or not, IP is only going to become more and more relevant as our lives become more and more digital. So regardless of what or how you feel about any aspect of IP, it's probably a good idea to have some basic knowledge of it. It doesn't matter if you're a consumer or a creator of protected content or both. Is understanding IP going to help you? You may rely on it. See you next week.
In this video, we'll discuss the six exclusive rights of the copyright law in depth, how they help you, why they're important. The first right is the right to copy a work. So that means make a copy. You can think of copying a copy machine. You can think of an MP3. and just what computers are best set up to do. The second one is the right to make a derivative work. And derivative means derived from. It's a work based on something you already did. The third of the exclusive rights is the right to distribute your work to the public. And by that is meant to sell it, to rent it, to lease it, to give it. Another right is the right to perform your work in public. It means only you can perform it in public unless you make an agreement and let someone issue them a license to perform your work. There are organizations that do that. And the next one, the fifth right, is the right to display your work in public, which might sound unusual. How do you display music? The way you display music is to display lyrics, for example. Put them on a greeting card or on clothing, something like that. That's the right to display music. The sixth right is the newest one, and it applies to one very specific item. It applies only to a digital audio recording. It says that you have the right to exclude anyone from broadcasting that recording, from streaming it. And that's why you saw the Beatles, Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Taylor Swift. A lot of people were not quick to have their music streamed, to be allowed. They had the right to that, the right to exclude it, till they had the right conditions. So to get into these rights a little more, first right is, again, the right to make a copy. And that's kind of simple, that's obvious. The second right, though, is the most fascinating of them all. It's a derivative, the right to make a derivative. By that is meant, say you wrote a song and the lyrics and the music just affected people in such a nice way that maybe someone wanted to make a movie out of it. How strange is that? I mean, could you turn a song into a movie? If you wrote the song, then you have the right to say, yes, okay, yeah, let's make a movie out of it. And not only one movie, let's make two or three or four movies. One of my favorite examples of a derivative work is taking a song and repurposing it, doing something else with it. There's a famous song from the 70s called The Gambler, written by Don Schlitz, recorded by Kenny Rogers. It was such a big hit, it tells an interesting story, that there was interest in making it into a movie. The person who gets to say yes or no, you can make a movie from it, is the songwriter. It was one person who wrote the words and music, Don Schlitz. So Don got to say, yeah, okay, I'll agree. And you can have extensive terms, you can control it in any way you want. There was one movie made of it, and that was successful. They ended up making five made-for-TV movies from his one song. That is a long way to go. That's taking one song and turning it into five movies. That's the power of a derivative work, that it could be repurposed like that. Someone could write another work and you could have it done by a symphony orchestra, a rearrangement of it. Think of what high school bands could do with it and college bands and so forth. So a lot can come out of a derivative work. It's one of the most powerful. The third exclusive right is the right to distribute your work to the public. By that, you can decide to sell your work for a certain amount of time, license it to someone else to sell. It could be set up as rental. For example, in Broadway and some other music, often when orchestras get the music, the score, the parts they need to perform it, they have to rent it. So they're not going to own it, and every time it gets performed, it's through rental. Fourth exclusive right is the right to perform your work publicly. Most of the time, what any songwriter wants is to have her work, his work, performed publicly. You don't want to put restrictions on it. You want to be paid for it. And this is where performance rights organizations come in as well. When your song is played in public, you are paid for that. There are various ways that can be worked out. But the right to perform it means if you don't want it performed, you can have it prevented. Normally speaking, that's a simple right. You just get it performed the way you want it to be performed. In the performance right, the right to perform your work publicly, there have been issues that have arisen when, for example, certain politicians use music of a recording artist when they are at a campaign appearance. Say, for example, I remember Ronald Reagan in the 80s running for president, and he liked the music of Bruce Springsteen. I think one of the songs was Born in the USA, and he wanted to use that. Springsteen didn't want him to, but Springsteen had an agreement that his music could be played in public if the venue had paid the performance fees, the licensing fees. And in this case, they had. So in Ronald Reagan's campaign event, in an auditorium of some public venue, if the venue had paid the performance fees and that was all done correctly, he was free to play Bruce Springsteen. However, what most politicians will do will realize, okay, Springsteen gave up part of his right. Like, I do have the right to play Bruce Springsteen's music, Reagan could think. But if the performer is famous and doesn't want me to, then I shouldn't. And that's what happened. There have been a lot of issues with that. There can be issues where if a politician always wanted to use a song, the politician could not use it in a recording that the politician featured and plays. If he does commercials for himself and plays your music, that's just another right of yours he's infringed upon. As a one-time thing in a live venue, then that's okay if the fee has been paid by the venue. But to use it as campaign advertising, then that's getting into more rights where the songwriter has the right to say no. The fifth of the exclusive rights is the right to display your work publicly. If you're a visual artist, this is a really big deal. If you're doing a painting, then you have the right to display it publicly. And we think of visual arts as being displayed. We think of songs as being played, not displayed. But music can be displayed, the lyrics in print. You might want to display your lyrics. You might want to put them on clothing or embroidery or all kinds of places you might want to do that. So if someone comes along who's very skilled and does nice work with metal and taking someone's lyrics and placing them into a nice copper mug for a Moscow mule kind of thing, you don't have the right to do that because you're taking someone else's lyrics. Even though you might have done this great artwork or this craft work with metal, you're using someone else's lyrics. You're displaying someone else's lyrics. That's where the display right with music, it usually involves something with that part of a song, with something. It has to be something visual. When it comes to display, I've seen legal issues where the copyright owners went after different artists, visual artists, who use Etsy. And you'll see this on T-shirts a lot. People will be selling T-shirts with lyrics from Nirvana, from the Beatles, from the Doors, and they'll be taking those lyrics and making beautiful designs and then putting them on T-shirts and selling them. The people who own the copyright to the lyrics almost always send cease and desist, or they go into business with them. That's something the Grateful Dead would do. If the Dead found someone were doing something like that, their approach was, oh, that's nice, let's make this work together. But that's the copyright owner's right to say, stop doing it, to prevent them, a cease and desist. But you should be creative. I think that's a better approach, and work with the people. The Grateful Dead were the best at that. In fact, they even used some works and some ideas that fans had done and created more trademarks based on that. The sixth right is the newest. It's from 1995. It's the right to say you can prevent your recording from being streamed, which means digital audio transmission. It means internet, satellite radio, anything that's digital transmission of your recording. You can prevent that from happening. And the reason you might want to do it, what the Beatles, the way they felt, and the Rolling Stones, it stemmed from first fear of the new and how do we control it. They didn't understand because the music industry was based for decades on selling goods, selling items, and maybe performances on AM and FM paid a certain amount. But with digital, the amount of money to be paid was going to be a lot less. They thought until they had a good deal on what they would be paid for digital audio transmission, they didn't want to do it. It had to be worked out. And Taylor Swift is a person who was at the forefront of this, of saying, I'm not going to allow it until it's done my way. And she has that right because of the sixth right. To repeat, there are six rights. They're very important. It's the federal government backing you as a copyright owner. First right is to right to make a copy. You can prevent anyone from copying your music. The second is to make a derivative. You can make a derivative in all kinds of things, and you can prevent anyone else from doing it. The right to offer your music, distribute it, sell it, rent it, lend it to the public. That's the third right. The fourth right is the right to perform it publicly. So it has to be the way you want it to work. So you have the right to say yes or no into how it should be performed. The fifth right is the right to display, which usually means, as I said, lyrics or some visual representation of the music. And the new sixth exclusive right is the right to prevent anyone from doing a digital audio transmission. So those are the six exclusive rights for copyright owners.
Beyond their rich cultural heritage, Native Americans possessed an innate genius for innovation, crafting tools and techniques that not only ensured their survival, but also shaped the course of history. You might be surprised to learn that many of these inventions continue to enrich our lives today, used by people worldwide. In this captivating episode, we will unveil the top 10 Native American inventions that have stood the test of time and are integral to our modern world. Join us as we delve into the fascinating stories behind these creations, from the artistry of crafting canoes to the practicality of snow goggles and so much more. But our exploration won't stop at the inventions themselves. We'll also celebrate the remarkable communities that nurtured these innovations and discover how they have evolved over the ages. Before we dive into this intriguing journey, do us a favor, show your support by liking this video and subscribing to our channel. By doing so, you'll ensure you never miss a glimpse of Native American history come alive. Now, without further ado, let's unveil the first invention on our extraordinary list. Number 1, the Three Sisters Farming Method. One major thing that made indigenous Native Americans stand out from other races was their excellent agricultural skill. They deliberately planted and produced the best crops, especially corn, which was the bane of their agricultural economy. To ensure quality food production, their ingenuity led them to invent the Three Sisters farming method, which is very much practiced to date. According to archaeologists, this approach, developed by various Native American tribes, most notably the Iroquois and the Cherokee, was first used around 1070 AD. The Three Sisters method involves establishing a symbiotic or, simply put, beneficial relationship by planting three different plants together. These three essential crops, which include corn, beans, and squash, utilize each other's benefits and, in turn, thrive well, leaving the natives with a bumper harvest. This agricultural method still holds valuable lessons for modern farming. Women select the best fields based on soil quality and carefully plant corn seeds. The corn's sturdy stalks were intended to support the climbing bean vines, eliminating the need for trellises or additional structures. After 2 or 3 weeks, they strategically placed bean seeds between the corn stalks. Beans, which are natural climbers, wend their way up the corn stalks. This vertical growth not only maximizes space utilization, but also fixes nitrogen in the soil through a mutually beneficial relationship with nitrogen-fixing bacteria in their root nodules. This nitrogen enrichment enhances the soil's fertility, benefiting all three crops. The third plant, squash, is planted between rows to utilize its broad leaves as a dense ground cover that shades the soil beneath, preventing weed growth and reducing moisture evaporation. The Three Sisters system naturally deters pests through the garden's physical structure and the plant's chemical composition. This minimizes the need for chemical pesticides, contributing to a healthier ecosystem. Number 2, canoes. In addition to their agricultural skills, Native Americans were known for their sophisticated skill in navigating water bodies. To aid easy transportation across rivers and fish seamlessly, they came up with the brilliant idea of building a wooden structure to help them stay afloat on water. This innovation birthed the canoe from the word kinu, meaning dugout. This dugout canoe was the earliest form of water transportation developed along the Pacific Northwest coast by tribes such as the Haida, Salish, and Tlingit. These canoes were crafted by hollowing out large cedar logs. The sturdy and seaworthy nature of dugout canoes made them suitable for coastal and open water navigation. In addition to transportation, they were also used for fishing and trading. To create this boat, the native people had a way of cutting down trees. They started a small fire at the bottom of a chosen tree and kept it burning until it fell over. They did this multiple times to make the tree shorter. Then, They used sticky substances like rosin and gum to light a fire inside the tree and scraped out the burned parts with seashells. They kept doing this until there was enough space inside the tree for people to sit. Overall, it was a lot of hard work and took a long time. The Inuit and Yupik people of the Arctic regions are credited with the invention of the kayak. These small, narrow watercraft were traditionally constructed from animal skins stretched over a wooden frame. Kayaks were designed to hunt seals and other marine mammals in icy waters. The design allowed for exceptional maneuverability and efficiency, making them a precursor to modern recreational kayaks for leisure and sporting events. Canoes have left an indelible mark on modern watercraft design. Today's kayaks, canoes, and even some motorized boats draw inspiration from the shape and construction methods of Native American canoes. The knowledge of canoe building has been preserved and passed down through generations. Number 3. Dream catchers. Dream catchers have their origins in the Ojibwe or Chippewa tribe, a Native American group that primarily inhabited the northern regions of what is now the United States and Canada. These intricate and symbolic objects were traditionally crafted by hand and held a special place in Ojibwe culture. A typical dream catcher consists of a circular frame, often made from willow or other flexible branches, forming a hoop. A woven net is created inside the hoop, resembling a spider's web. This web is meant to capture negative dreams or energy while allowing positive dreams to pass through. Feathers, beads, and other decorative elements are often attached to the bottom of the hoop. The Ojibwe people believe that dream catchers had the power to protect the sleeper from harmful dreams. According to their beliefs, dream catchers would act as a filter for dreams when hung near the bed or sleeping area. The web would trap bad dreams, preventing them from reaching the dreamer. Nowadays, dream catchers are often used for purposes beyond their traditional role as dream filters. They have become iconic decorative items, adorning homes, cars, and clothing. They are also commonly given as gifts, especially to mark significant life events or to bring positive energy into a space. Number 4. Chewing gum. While chewing gum is not solely attributed to Native American invention, it's worth mentioning that indigenous cultures in the Americas significantly influenced its popularity and use to date. The Mayans and Aztecs of Mesoamerica were among the first to use chicle, a natural latex derived from the sapodilla tree. Chicle was chewed for its pleasant flavor and the potential dental benefits it offered. Many Native American tribes had their chewing gum traditions. They would use various plant resins and sap, often mixing them with natural sweeteners like honey or maple sap to create a chewable substance. For example, the Apache people used resin from the juniper tree. The use of chicle by indigenous cultures caught the attention of European explorers. In the late 19th century, chicle became an essential ingredient in the development of commercial chewing gum. Thomas Adams, an American inventor, is often credited with creating the first commercially successful chewing gum using chicle in the 1870s. This paved the way for the emergence of iconic chewing gum brands like Wrigley's and Chiclets. These brands contributed to the global popularity of chewing gum as a recreational activity and a breath freshener. Today, chewing gum is widely available in various flavors and forms, from sticks and pellets to bubble gum. Number 5. Moccasins. Moccasin derives from the Algonquian word moccasin, which means shoe or footwear. This footwear has been worn by Native American people for thousands of years, with some archaeological evidence dating moccasins back to as early as 3,500 years ago. Moccasins are typically made from soft, supple leather or animal hides, which offer durability and flexibility. The choice of materials often depends on what is locally available, such as deer, moose, buffalo, or other hides. They are then sewn together with plant fibers, creating strong and flexible seams. Some tribes used beadwork or decorative stitching to decorate their moccasins. These shoes often have a soft, soleless bottom or a thin leather sole, which allows the wearer to feel the ground beneath them. This design provides a more natural connection to the earth. Today, moccasins are celebrated for their comfort and distinctive style. Many fashion enthusiasts worldwide wear moccasins as casual or even semi-formal footwear. They are available in various styles, including low-cut slip-ons, ankle-high boots, and knee-high boots, often made from various materials, including suede and leather. One of the primary reasons moccasins remain popular today is their comfort. The soft, flexible soles make them a comfortable choice for everyday wear and are often chosen for lounging around the house or running errands. Some modern moccasins feature cushioned insoles for added comfort. Number 6. Snow goggles. Predecessors of today's popular sunglasses, snow goggles were a crucial invention by indigenous peoples inhabiting the Arctic and sub-Arctic regions, including the Inuit, Yupik, and other Native American groups. These innovative eyewear items were designed not only for protection from the blinding glare of snow, but also to safeguard against the harmful effects of intense UV radiation on the eyes. This concern remains relevant to date. The construction of snow goggles was remarkably effective. They featured narrow slits carved into a piece of bone or wood. This design allowed for a narrow field of vision, mimicking squinting eyes, which prevented the harsh sunlight from blinding the wearer. The materials used were selected for their insulating properties, protecting against the biting cold. Additionally, the small slits helped to trap warm air close to the eyes, reducing the risk of frostbite. Number 7. Mouthwash. The Native Americans weren't originally inventors of mouthwash. Every tribe and continent had their methods of maintaining adequate oral hygiene. However, the natives' method of mouth cleansing stood out. One popular herb used by the natives is known as the gold thread, or yellow root. It is a perennial herb native to North America, particularly the eastern United States and Canada. What makes this herb so unique? Gold thread contains a compound called berberine, which possesses powerful antimicrobial properties. Berberine has been shown to inhibit the growth of various bacteria, including those responsible for dental plaque and gum disease. Native Americans recognized these properties and utilized gold thread as an herbal remedy for maintaining oral health. Today, while modern mouthwash formulations are more sophisticated and convenient, they owe a debt of gratitude to the Native American cultures that took it upon themselves to explore the benefits of natural ingredients for oral care. Number 8. Syringes. While the invention of the syringe is often attributed to Alexander Wood, a Scottish physician, in the mid-19th century, it's important to recognize that Native American cultures had their versions of syringes long before this time. It wouldn't just be considered what you might call sterile. Due to the type of materials used, Native Americans, particularly the Eastern Woodlands tribes, crafted syringes from natural materials like animal bones and hollowed out bird bones with an end sharpened to a point. This pointed end allowed for the precise delivery of fluids. A plunger, often made from a pliable material like a piece of animal intestine or leather, was used to create suction and expel the liquid. Native American healers depended heavily on various herbal remedies and concoctions, and the syringe facilitated their precise administration. Furthermore, they were instrumental in procedures such as wound irrigation, abscess drainage, and other forms of localized treatment. Today, syringes are an indispensable tool in healthcare for administering medications, vaccinations, and performing various medical procedures. This evolution from the traditional Native American syringes to the sophisticated sterile syringes of modern medicine demonstrates how ancient knowledge has contributed to the progress of healthcare practices worldwide. Number 9. Bunk beds. Yes, the bunk beds you see today result from the ingenuity of indigenous Native American tribes. Plains tribes, including the Lakota Sioux, Cheyenne, and Arapaho, often lived in teepees. These teepees were relatively small living spaces, and accommodating multiple family members required efficient use of the available space. Bunk beds were created to aid space optimization, allowing for more sleeping areas without compromising the teepee's floor space. As European settlers encountered Native American tribes and their way of life, they observed the efficiency of bunk beds and the benefits of vertical sleeping arrangements. This influence gradually entered Western culture, where bunk beds became a popular solution for maximizing space in cramped quarters, such as military barracks and children's bedrooms. Number 10. Pain relievers. Last but not least, it is a revolutionary innovation in medicine. This began with the discovery of the willow tree by Native Americans alongside its health benefits. Willow bark contains salicin, which is a natural precursor to aspirin. Tribes like the Cherokee and Chippewa brewed willow bark tea to reduce fever and alleviate pain. The Iroquois utilized this plant for treating intense sore throat and stomach pain. This practice laid the foundation for developing the modern aspirin you see and use.
Black history. These inventions were made by black inventors and not whites. We are diving into a very interesting topic of history that has made a very big change in everyone's life. We will highlight the inventiveness, originality, and tenacity of a group of individuals that has frequently been ignored in the annals of history. In this video, we will be telling you about some great inventions that were made by black inventors and not whites. They have made such successful inventions which have eased the lives of people. If you want to know about such great things, then stay with us until the end. Before we explore the fascinating world of innovation, let's take a moment to pause and consider black history. We're going to talk about black innovators whose amazing inventions have advanced current technology. Black people's history in America is one of struggle, repression, and prejudice. Black people were denied basic human rights, treated like second-class citizens for centuries, and exposed to horrible acts of violence and cruelty. The path to equality has been long and arduous, from slavery to segregation, but African Americans never gave up despite all the challenges. One way they accomplished this was through innovation as they fought for their rights, their dignity, and their role in society. Innovation. You read it right. Black inventors were able to create groundbreaking ideas and technologies that revolutionized the globe despite being denied access to education, resources, and chances. Did you know that George Washington Carver's research on peanuts helped revolutionize agriculture and food production? Thomas L. Jennings, known as the Black Edison, also invented more than a dozen devices that revolutionized the railroad industry in the late 1800s. Thomas L. Jennings was the first black inventor to receive a patent for his dry cleaning process in 1821. These are just a few of the many black inventors who have significantly improved modern technology, including blood banks, traffic lights, the Super Soaker water pistol, and modern gas masks. Black inventors have left their mark on the world, so join me as we explore the fascinating world of black inventors and their amazing contributions to modern technology. The first person on our list is a man whose numerous contributions to modern technology have earned him the title of Godfather of Silicon Valley. Clay started working for Fairchild Semiconductor in the 1960s, where he was instrumental in the growth of the business's computer section. Clay made some of his most important contributions to the field of computer science while he was an employee at Fairchild. One of Clay's greatest contributions was the creation of the first computer chipset, which enabled the integration of many circuits onto a single chip. Modern microprocessors, which are utilized in everything from smartphones to supercomputers, were made possible because of this innovation. The first microcomputer, a smaller, cheaper substitute for the then-current huge, pricey mainframe computers, was also significantly influenced by Clay. The creation of the tiny computer opened up computing to businesses and individuals, and it also helped prepare the way for the 1980s personal computer revolution. In addition to his employment at Fairchild Clay, Rod L. Electronics, his technology firm, was established in 1970. The business concentrated on creating cutting-edge computer equipment, including some of the first computer networking hardware. Along with being a trailblazing engineer and innovator throughout his career, Clay served as a mentor to countless other engineers and business owners. He was a founding member of Hewlett-Packard's computer division and sat on the boards of several technology companies, including Intel and Apple. Despite his tremendous achievements, Clay's contributions to computer science are frequently unappreciated. He had tremendous discrimination and challenges throughout his career as a black man working in a field that was largely composed of white people. But the numerous innovations he contributed to the development of the countless people he inspired and taught along the road ensure that his legacy endures. The sprinkler for the lawn was created by Joseph A. Smith. an African-American inventor named Joseph A. Smith, born in Cincinnati, Ohio in 1867. He was an inventor and a businessman, and his innovation of the lawn sprinkler completely changed how people irrigated their lawns and gardens. He had the concept for the lawn sprinkler while employed as an Ohio gardener. He noted that the plants that received hand watering grew more robustly than the unwatered ones. He also saw that many individuals were squandering water by watering their gardens and lawns with hoses. Smith started experimenting with various irrigation methods to find a more effective way to irrigate plants. He eventually developed a lawn sprinkler that could be attached to a hose and used to water lawns and gardens. His lawn sprinkler was unique because it was adjustable and could be set to water specific areas of the lawn or garden. Additionally, it was made to save water by using a system of revolving nozzles that dispersed water in a circular manner as opposed to wasting water by dispersing it randomly. After Smith's lawn sprinkler was granted a patent in 1897, homeowners and landscape architects flocked to use it. It was especially helpful in places with a lack of water or where there were watering restrictions. We can argue that Joseph Smith's development of the lawn sprinkler had an enduring influence on contemporary technology and contributed to the improvement of our world. Lawn sprinklers are now utilized in commercial agriculture as well as residential settings. The blood banks were developed by Charles Richard. An excellent surgeon and doctor of African descent, he revolutionized the American healthcare system. Richard was interested in blood transfusions and the value of having a ready supply of blood for unexpected medical situations. He was aware that during operations and other medical procedures, blood loss could be a serious cause of demise. Richard made a crucial advancement in the field of blood transfusions in 1938. He found that blood could be preserved for later use by preventing it from clotting by using the anticoagulant sodium citrate. This was a groundbreaking discovery since it made it possible to establish blood banks where people could store and use their blood as needed. Richard's discovery was particularly important during World War II, when there was a high demand for blood transfusions. Blood banks made it possible to provide blood to soldiers on the battlefield and save countless lives. Richard's invention also played a crucial role in the treatment of anemia, leukemia, and other blood disorders. However, his invention was not without challenges. The medical community was very opposed to the creation of blood banks, especially those who thought that stored blood could not be utilized properly despite the difficulties. Richard persisted in his efforts to increase the effectiveness and safety of blood transfusions. Richard made groundbreaking contributions to the medical community, and his work has had an ongoing influence on modern medicine. Blood banks have helped save countless lives and are now a crucial part of modern healthcare. As we continue to develop and push the boundaries of what is possible, it is obvious that Black innovators have had a significant impact on molding the world in which we now live. By promoting a more inclusive and equitable future for all, we can honor the trailblazers who came before us and pay tribute to their legacy. If you've liked what you've heard in this video, please don't be a stranger. It would help us out greatly if you would like, subscribe, and share these videos so we can get this information to other folks who may be just as interested as you were.
There's no reason for intellectual property to exist. This week, we're looking at how and why we should abolish this idea to replace it with something better. First things first, let's talk about insulin. Insulin is a life-saving drug. It can be the difference between a pretty normal, long life and the constant risk of ketoacidosis, diabetic coma, and premature death for millions of people around the world. And yet, despite only costing $10 to produce a vial's worth, about 1 in 5 Americans with diabetes can't afford treatment and need to ration their insulin. That's because insulin is way too expensive. In the US, it's estimated that insulin prices jump between 15 and 17% every single year. Today, a 10 mL vial costs around $300. When it used to be just 20 bucks back in 1996. In this country, monthly insulin costs regularly exceed $1,000 for those without insurance. So many diabetics in the US have had to resort to incredibly dangerous strategies to get to the end of the month, like not eating, not testing their blood sugar level, or simply not giving their body the amount of insulin it needs. At the core of this problem, and many, many others, is the concept of intellectual property. Currently, the different patents to produce insulin are held by three companies in the US: Eli Lilly, Novo Nordisk, and Sanofi. Together, they control about 90% of the insulin market. And through the yearly tradition of patenting minuscule changes to their process and formula, they've made sure that no generic version of the drug can be manufactured by anybody else. Thanks to intellectual property laws, just three companies have a fully legal cartel, an oligopoly. And all of this despite the formula for synthetic insulin being 100 years old at this point, and the original creators selling the first patent for only a dollar, refusing to rake in massive profits for their invention in the hopes it would be universally accessible someday. The story is almost identical with COVID vaccines. Just a couple companies own the patents to the most effective ones, and have been on a price gouging spree for years at this point. Seeing ahead of time how this would play out, all the way back in October of 2020, India, South Africa, and over 100 other countries went to the World Trade Organization to request that intellectual property restrictions be waived on COVID vaccines, testing, and treatment so that they could actually try to limit the dangers of this already deadly virus. But the patent owners are powerful, and so is the US, the country where most of these patents are registered. So they made sure they would stay quote-unquote protected, notably by hiring over 100 lobbyists to make sure their IP wouldn't be released to anyone. These companies, through the US's leadership, made sure that the WTO would refuse to waive existing restrictions, which it did for over 600 days, dragging out the pandemic for months while infections continued to spread. When finally these restrictions were waived, not too long ago, and millions of preventable deaths later, the WTO's plan didn't even include waiving IP protections for tests or treatments, only vaccines. So, like with just about everything, poorer countries are forced to face the consequences of a disease we can mitigate and control without adequate resources. Not because we don't have the means to produce them, but because the knowledge required to do so is held for ransom. And the consequences are grim. According to Oxfam, for every life lost in a rich country, another 4 people have died in a poorer nation due to COVID. There is no doubt that universal access to COVID-related IP would have made a difference. In their attempt to justify this ghoulish behavior, pharma companies have argued that this is about protecting innovation. That without strong, exclusionary IP laws, they'd have no incentive to produce these vaccines and innovation would just shrivel up. But they don't even believe this themselves. These same companies now defending IP laws like it's their favorite Minecraft streamer getting canceled on Twitter are the same companies who, right at the start of the pandemic, desperately clamored for IP laws to be dropped in order to develop the vaccines we know today. This has nothing to do with innovation and everything to do with profit. Like everyone else who defends IP, they're kicking away the ladder. Using publicly available knowledge, or in this case, going around existing IP laws to develop something, then once they're on top, acting like IP laws are sacred natural rights that the state must protect at any cost, including tremendous loss of life. Climbing the ladder, then kicking it away so no one else can do the same. And who can blame them? This strategy works. The US has been doing the exact same thing for years. To become the industrial powerhouse of the 19th and 20th centuries, the US encouraged and actively engaged in IP theft. Once upon a time, Britain had kickstarted the Industrial Revolution, and in the process, set up laws to make sure its innovations wouldn't get out. It had used processes and resources it had stolen across the world, and now it was time to kick the ladder. But the US didn't like lagging behind. So some of the country's founding fathers made sure that any industrial spy willing to bring over the new technology of water-powered textile mills and those dope mechanical looms everyone was talking about would be legally protected in the US. So that's what happened. The first industrial machine in the country, this textile mill in Rhode Island, widely considered the birthplace of the American Industrial Revolution, wasn't the product of American genius and innovation, nor of the strength of IP laws, but plain and simple IP theft. Today, though, now that it's at the top of the ladder, it's America's turn to kick. On the international stage, the US preaches the sanctity of IP laws, and has even built an international system of enforcement to go with it. On the rhetorical front, the US will often claim that China steals hundreds of billions of dollars a year from the US through IP theft, an amount that's calculated by assuming every counterfeit good sold for cheap is equivalent to losing a sale of the expensive original version, which, obviously, it's not. Most people buy things when they're cheap, meaning any IP theft calculation you see is almost guaranteed to be inflated. Regardless, the US is basically complaining about China doing the same thing it did all those years ago when it was in the same position, developing in the shadow of a wealthier hegemon. Alongside this more symbolic pressure, though, the US and the rest of the Imperial Corps have also set up TRIPS, the Agreement on Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Rights. TRIPS is an international pact signed by just about every country in the world to police the kind of IP theft that the US so handsomely profited from earlier in its development. While the World Trade Organization tries to portray TRIPS as a benevolent global enforcement system, all it actually does is grant powerful countries legal protections over their IP monopolies, while keeping poorer countries down. That's because rich countries are almost always sellers of IP, thanks to centuries of exploitation of the global south, and poor countries are almost always buyers. A system like TRIPS that enforces the same IP protections for everyone, regardless of how much intellectual property they're actually able to produce, therefore effectively locks poor countries into total dependence on Western IP, since the funds that would otherwise go towards developing new technologies and expanding on the innovations that start out in the West are instead spent buying basic IP from the only legal sellers. As if all this wasn't bad enough, there's a possibility that IP laws may become even more important in coming years. Studies have shown that copyright-intensive industries, like motion pictures, publishing, and software, are seeing their profit margins grow over time, whereas more material-driven industries, like construction, transportation, and mining, are on the decline. It is increasingly safe to profit with IP, and risky to go down the traditional path. Market rules being what they are, investors will follow the money. But this doesn't just mean more movies and songs. In the book Four Futures: Life After Capitalism, author Peter Fraze takes this trend to its logical conclusion and imagines what chasing IP profits might turn into. And it doesn't look good. In a hypothetical world where material scarcity has been overcome, where profits are no longer made by taking real things, transforming them, and selling them for more, capitalists will seek refuge from irrelevancy by holding on to intellectual property. IP owners would sit at the top of society, only needing to hire a small class of creators to produce the property for them, marketers to sell it, and lawyers to fight IP disputes, reducing the rest of society to simple consumers, blocked behind paywalls to access products protected by IP laws without the ability to actually enjoy the fact that abundance is possible, and that no one would technically need to lack anything. The world would have seemingly infinite resources, limited only by the parasitic need to find profit somewhere. Fraze's thought experiment is an extreme example of how far things might go. But what it ultimately highlights is something we already know exists today. Capitalism requires scarcity to function. And in the absence of material scarcity, intellectual property allows capitalists to maintain it artificially to our collective detriment. And look, I know that so far I've talked at a very macro scale, either in terms of millions of people, countries, or entire future societies, but this is probably not what you expected from this video. The first thing that comes to everyone's mind with IP is artists, authors, musicians, inventors, basically any sort of independent creator. IP usually is not sold to us as a way to protect big pharmaceutical companies' profits or the privilege of a small class of IP owners. It's usually about sticking up for the little guy, making sure that when they create something, someone more powerful and capable can't come in and rip them off. And if IP actually did that, it really would be great. But the reality is that that's not who IP actually benefits. That doesn't mean these concerns aren't valid, and I'll address them when I sketch out the socialist alternative to IP later. But as it stands, that's just not who IP protects. On the contrary, large companies, most notably in the tech sector, have weaponized IP against independent creatives and smaller competitors. By filing thousands of patents a year, companies like Apple and Google have created portfolios that they can bring into the courtroom. Whenever Apple sniffs out that someone is innovating down a path they're interested in for themselves, they'll go fishing in their portfolio of purposefully and necessarily vague patents to find something similar that they already own. They'll then take their competition to court, drowning smaller fish in years-long expensive disputes that Apple has the budget to win and that most others don't. In a complete reversal of what we're told IP law is supposed to do, the little guy is absolutely screwed over. And this is not even addressing how companies claim their workers' IP as their own, or publishing houses and record labels, where IP is siphoned up and away from creators, landing in the hands of a class of rent-seeking capitalists who produce nothing and simply have the means to acquire the rights to the work of others. So, given all these problems, given the natural monopolies that IP creates, the price gouging, the loss of life traded for profit, the stifling of innovation, and everything else, what might a socialist alternative look like? Here are a few ideas, and if you have more, by all means, put them in the comments. Obviously, the first thing that a socialist society should do is make sure information is free. That means that it should be both free to circulate everywhere and not cost anything to the person consuming it, for lack of a better word. This doesn't mean, however, that it shouldn't be compensated. A key socialist criticism of capitalism is that it appropriates workers' labor for the propertied class. So any socialist society where money is still a necessity can't be doing something similar to its intellectual producers. As both a way to compensate and incentivize intellectual production, then, a socialist society could go down a few different paths. Socialist governments could establish various funds, like an art fund, an engineering fund, or a fund for researchers in applied sciences. Like the grant system that exists today, people would apply to a democratic board for funding to conduct research or produce something with the stipulation that whatever they create enters the public domain once it's done. The labor has been compensated, but no monopoly over the knowledge has been established, and it can circulate freely, helping someone else stand on the shoulders of their fellow giants. These funds could be accompanied by investment programs into communal resources that help innovation writ large, like investing more into properly equipped science labs in schools, for example, in order to set a baseline from which anyone can have access to resources without seeking specific project-based approval. In addition, universities and other research institutions could obviously be staffed with people hired specifically to conduct R&D or produce creative work year-round, like exists today, without patents or IP claims being filed once the research is done. Since it's possible for this infrastructure to reject or otherwise not apply to some creators, a socialist society could also create a more decentralized platform for crowdfunding. On this platform, people could propose the projects they're interested in creating, set a price according to the labor it would require to bring into the world, and if enough people agree that this is a worthwhile idea, they'd chip in and it would happen. Here again, people would be paid for their work, but the thing they produce would be accessible to all for free, and the kind of freeloading that exists in any sort of system where money changes hands would be minimized by the fact that projects that don't get funded don't see the light of day. So if you want something to happen, you probably need to chip in. In all these ideas, labor is properly compensated without an extractive monopoly forming after the fact. You are still incentivized to innovate and can even get paid, so we're not exclusively relying on people creating for the fun of it, and what you produce can actually be used by everyone who might benefit from it, not just those who can afford it. In parallel, a sort of patent office could still exist under socialism, but only to keep track of the various intellectual products and prevent fraud. For example, to make sure that something you didn't write isn't being distributed with your name on it, or that something you did write isn't being passed off by someone else as their original work. It wouldn't grant you a monopoly over pricing, all information circulates freely, but it could protect your reputation, give you proper credit, and serve a larger societal purpose by creating a database where like-minded creators could find each other or get inspired. Again, these are just ideas, and I'll link where I found some of them in the description. You will undoubtedly be able to find problems with some of them, or maybe even come up with better alternatives yourself. They're not here as an official plan or anything, but to communicate the fact that there are alternatives. IP almost always has disastrous and unjustified consequences. Innovations that are the fruit of thousands of different factors, of knowledge accumulated over centuries, resources given for free to a country's citizens like education, public libraries, and publicly funded research, get privatized and suddenly become the last link in the chain. Incremental work, done by thousands of people, suddenly stops being passed on freely from one person to the next as soon as intellectual property is claimed. While creating IP laws might incentivize innovation for one person, guaranteeing them a monopoly over the pattern they produce, it makes it infinitely harder to innovate for the thousands of people who will come after them and will have to deal with however this monopoly over information is handled. IP laws put a barrier between what a person creates and how others might use it, getting in the way of the development of new ideas, and forcing everyone to try to come up with new knowledge without drawing the ire of IP tyrants. There's nothing natural about intellectual property rights, or any private property rights for that matter. They aren't handed down to us by God or the universe. They were created by capitalist and liberal thinkers to justify and enforce a calculated system of exploitation. We can easily come up with something better. A better, more innovative world is possible.
A storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. This freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your brother, Ramiro Disoka. Yeah. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast episode. Today I want to talk with you about intellectual property. Now, I didn't know what intellectual property was until I went to college. And while in college, I learned about it, obviously. And I still remember, you know, reading in the business book about intellectual property. And stopping for a brief moment to think about how crazy of an idea intellectual property was in relationship to the laws limiting, supposedly, its transfer and ownership. Now, just for those of you who don't know, I went to college I started college in 2007. No, I was not 18 in 2007. That was just when I finally started it. I went from 207 to 209. And so, I had to have heard intellectual property said a few times prior to that, you know, considering it really came into vogue when I was a child in the 80s and the 90s. But really understanding its implications, it didn't really strike me until, you know, I was in college reading about it. Over the next 2 years of my being in college, I really started seeing the idea of intellectual property as historically silly. And I started seeing it as historically silly because even without that much education, I knew that colonialism worked as well as it did because Europeans stole a hell of a lot of ideas and, quote, inventions and other things from the people that they wanted to rule over. So I also understood, and this came, you know, in my 20s, I also understood that for black people, especially black inventors. The only black administrator or teacher I ever had in my life had this book on black inventors, and I remember being in awe in high school looking through this book and being like, holy crap, look at all this stuff black people invented. There was a section in there, though, about people enslaved who invented stuff, but were never given the credit for it because they were enslaved. And so I knew that black people did not have, especially enslaved blacks, didn't have any property rights that would have protected their inventions from being stolen. And even, you know, presently, over the last 15 or so years, we've discovered that a number of things that white people have been making tons of money off of for years, decades, were not invented by them, but were invented by black folks who weren't able to get patents or get the necessary money to build the facilities that would have been required to make whatever they wanted to make. I mean, I understood this. I got this. So to read about intellectual property was stunning to me. Absolutely staggeringly stunning to me. And after I was done with college, and not necessarily by choice, but had to because I had to work, and I was still doing reading. I was reading stuff, you know. I would come home and I'd read a few pages here, read a few pages there. Sometimes I'd read a bunch of pages, you know. It became even clearer because I was reading books about the beginning of capitalism, what actually helped capitalism propel itself. I was reading books on labor philosophy and labor issues that were going on at the late 1800s, early 1900s. It became clear to me, again, just how arbitrary intellectual property rights have always been. That if you are in an outcasted group, let's say you are a bunch of radicals and you were putting together intellectual material, there was no protection that was given to you or given to that material that you were producing because it was considered radical. If you were a person or group of people that were putting together intellectual writings that capitalists thought were not positive for capitalism, there was nothing that could protect those writings from being destroyed. And, you know, we are currently going through a phase where the right wing is wanting to get rid of, they want to ban books, and trust me, the book burnings are coming. I'm waiting for those. But they want to ban tons of books after a couple of years ago being like, oh, well, the left is trying to ban Dr. Seuss. Anyway, this is nothing new. Capitalist conservatives have always wanted to limit the reach of non-capitalist intellectual work, of critical intellectual work. And it's really, 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 really hilarious to me because today, all of this talk about immigrants, when back then, 120 years ago, there was not only talk about immigrants coming from the wrong parts of Europe to the United States by capitalist conservatives, but also the outdated ideas that they were bringing over. They were bringing over ideas about freedom and liberty that didn't mesh well with capitalist standards because these people had ancient traditions that they wanted to keep a hold of. So I find that hilarious. But getting back to this point, when I was reading one of these books, it was on the invention of capitalism. I've mentioned it before. I would encourage all of you to get it. I did not realize it was written by a Marxist when I wrote it, but it is really one of the best introductory histories on capitalism that you could find. And it's not an extraordinarily long book. It's called The Invention of Capitalism by Michael Perlman, P-E-R-E-L-M-A-N, which I found interesting because most people just think capitalism happened naturally. It did not. But he talked about something in the book which really sparked my mind, called the enclosure movement. Now, I had never heard of the enclosure movement. I didn't know what the enclosure movement was, and I immediately went to work trying to find out. I mean, he explained a bit of it, but I went to work, okay, what is this thing called the enclosure movement? The enclosure movement was the taking of common lands, lands shared by all the people, specifically in England, and parcelling them off into plots of land for people to, quote, live on and develop and basically do what they want with it. They destroyed the commons so people... Did you hear what I said? They destroyed the commons so people with money and wealth could have more land. And by doing this, they would often take places, pieces of land, large common pieces of land that large groups of people would use to actually sustain themselves. Again, did you hear what I said? They would take large pieces of land that large groups of people would use to sustain themselves, meaning they could live off the land. They would parcel it up, sell it to rich people, and then punish and arrest and abuse the ordinary individuals who had been using it often for centuries to live, and force those people then to go and work in cities and mills, and in essence, force them to go and work for the capitalists. This is quite important, y'all. This is quite important. Why? Because when I learned about this, this was, by the way, not something that had to be introduced heavily into the United States because it was kind of already there because of how the colonial system worked. Colonies were already enclosed. And then they would just keep entrenching on new land that was owned by common writ by indigenous peoples, and then they would enclose that land and that would become part of the colonies. But when I learned about this, I said, oh, well, wait a dang minute. This is how property is created. So, you know, there is a respect for what people could own, and there's a respect for what is common, what binds us all together. But what capitalism does is it takes parcels of the common area that we consider sacred to be for all of us, that sustain us, and then it starts chopping away at those common areas and making profit off of them. Oh, this is, okay, so this is how property is made. Now, it wasn't until some years later when I connected this to intellectual property, and by some years later, I mean like several months later, because I completely misremembered this idea. I was thinking that the next time that I made that major leap was like 2015, 2016, when a light bulb went off on something completely different, but it connected back to intellectual property. But in fact, there is a book that I listened to. I think it's called The Ascent of Man. And it's a, dang it. And I can't even remember the author of it. It's been that long since I've listened to the book. But the beginning of the book talks about the art aspect of intellectual property. And how young people, so this book was written, if I remember correctly, in the early 2000s. I was listening to it in 2011. And so the author was talking about, he was teaching in a college. And, you know, he's talking to these kids and he asks them, he says, you know, who likes music here? Everybody's hand goes up. How many of you have downloaded music illegally? Because at that time, there was a obvious big trend among young people on the internet, including friends I knew, of downloading music and media illegally. They were actually file sharing it, you know, to be honest. It wasn't, well, they're downloading it from the internet. No, people had it. They allowed people to take it from one computer to another, yada, yada, yada. Anyway, everybody's hand shot up. Now, mind you, he asked them, and everyone's hand, and then he wanted to know why. He asked the question, why? Which, you know, it's funny, because law's like, well, I don't care why, because it's just the law. Yeah, well, okay, let me ask you this. Why is it the law? Why is it the law? Native Americans, Native Indigenous people, were living in this place for tens of thousands of years before white folks got here. What is your law compared to what laws they had? Oh, that's right. They don't count because you're God and they're not. Okay. We'll see who's God soon enough, I suppose, because Mother Nature's going to prove who's God and who lives forever. Anyway, continuing. What he discovered when he asked why was that these young people had an understanding of music that is very similar to the way that I heard people speak about music in some of the old books that I was reading. They saw music as a common good. Not common good as in, oh, well, I can trade this to make money. No, good as in something that is meant to be enjoyed by large groups of people. Now, you might say, well, yeah, but people have to get paid and people have to da-da-da-da. Yes, people do have to get paid. Yes. Yes. But let's be very clear about this. And this was something that a friend of mine explained to me and didn't really have to because I had the numbers already. Most of the people getting paid from the music that was being made back then were not the artists. The money was going into the pockets of people who were ripping off the artists and often leaving the artists broke without money. But they were living fabulous lives. It wasn't about making the artists money. It was about making them money. And most of the young folks knew this. They knew that artists didn't make their money from selling songs. They made their money from going on tour. They knew this. There was an understanding in that conversation about the difference between what should be for profit and what should be, if not non-for-profit, then minimally profitized. And I found that very interesting, especially as I started understanding and appreciating and approaching intellectual property more. Moreover, at the same time, I was reaching out to a well-known foundation. I won't say who it is. Or maybe I could. Could I? Yeah, no. I'm not going to say who it is. I'm trying to get my hands on... Well, no, I can say who it is. So I was reaching out to the King Center. And, you know, I've since went back and looked at my strategy and my approach to it. And I was very green. I was very excited. And I didn't 100% jump in the right way. Get it now, you know, older, wiser. But I was reaching out to the King Center to try to get my hands on some of King's lesser-known speeches. And I proposed in one of the pieces that I wrote to him, I said, you know, I could actually make some YouTube videos for you, you know, do maybe a podcast or something, you know, really get the word out on what Dr. King was about. And it went nowhere. And so I started reaching out to colleges, because I found colleges that had speeches that hadn't really been released publicly. And I would start reaching out to these places and start talking with them. And I met one brick wall after another brick wall after another brick wall and started getting frustrated. And I met this one archivist. And, you know, he said, look, man, I'm going to tell you, like, we own our stuff, so I can definitely send you what we have. So I had to pay for them to press a CD, and they actually sent me a CD back in, like, 2012, I think it was. But he goes, look, I'm going to tell you, man, it's going to be hard sledding. And I was like, why? I mean, this, it's Dr. King, and there's so much of his stuff that hasn't been released, and I don't understand. And he goes, dude, it is because the King family is very litigious. Now, I knew what litigious meant, so I wasn't dumb. And I was like, okay, I get that. They don't want people misusing his stuff. But, dude, it's 2012. We live in a digital age. How could they hold basically his legacy hostage for my generation, now the younger generation, and expect us to carry on to do his work when we have more access to people who are misusing small quotes of Dr. King than to actual access or to the access to his actual works? And he goes, look, I get it, brother, but I'm telling you, they're very litigious, and so schools are very skeptical. They don't want to anger them. They don't want to open doors to nobody unless there's direct correspondence between the King Center, yada, 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 yada. It blew my mind. I reached out tons of times to other schools and found again that he was right. Very few of them wanted to hand over these pieces. They didn't want to hand over those King speeches, those King sermons that I was requesting. And again, I heard time and time again from people who were very sympathetic, look, we understand, but they own the intellectual property rights, and they've pretty much put the fear of God in all of us. So we don't want to get in any trouble, so we're not releasing nothing. You can come down, you can listen to it, you know, but you just can't have a copy of it. And so that was really like my first introduction into the world of intellectual property. It's like, okay. One thing after another, running into this door, that door, this one, this wall, this, you know. Now, you might say, well, that probably soured you a bit for intellectual property. No, actually, it didn't sour me any more than I was already sour about intellectual property. That taught me that I have to be persistent. I just have to keep pushing through, and no matter what. And I found some people who are willing to share, some people who are willing to not necessarily skirt the rules, but, you know, say we own these archives, and we're not really concerned about getting, you know, fined or anything, so here, you can have it. But it was very few and far between. I probably contacted 100 schools, and out of those 100, probably 12, probably a dozen, maybe a baker's dozen were willing to give me copies, especially audio copies of Dr. King's material. Just to let y'all know quickly before I jump back into the intellectual property stuff, what you know as exist or as being in existence for Dr. King when it comes to his speeches, especially those that were recorded, family, you have no clue. You have no clue. There is over 100 speeches that Dr. King recorded, known, held in hand. Speeches and sermons that man gave. of listening quality. They may not all be sharp listening quality, and they probably would have been in better listening quality if they were digitized earlier or transferred earlier onto better I'd say tape, because these were old enough to be transferred onto better tape. But there's over 100 of them that are known to exist of his voice, and those have never seen the light of day except for a few people having them. I hope someday those become circulated. I really do. And additionally, there are over 100 unknown, or not, I guess not unknown, especially if you look through the archives, but not well known speeches and sermons that he gave that should be well known. But, you know, like I said, I hope someday those become more widely distributed, because they need to be. And to the King Center, I don't know when you guys are going to finally get around to publishing the rest of the volumes in the scholar. I don't even know what they're called. The papers of Martin Luther King. I don't know when you guys are going to get around to doing the rest of those, but they need to get done. You know, go beyond 1965, 1964. But anyway, moving on. Now, the reason I want to talk to you guys about intellectual property today is because, one, I view intellectual property, the idea of intellectual property, as the last gasp of capitalism, outside of it turning completely fascist. Because with nothing else to commodify, the only thing left is this idea of intellectual property. That's one. Number two, I believe the idea of intellectual property rights really kills innovation. And I don't have to describe much to help you see that. I don't have to describe much to help you see that. In the early 1990s, I've mentioned this before, there was a law that was passed to limit and constrict the intellectual property rights of those who own master recordings and produce works of art. And are the original producers of works of art. And supposedly, the idea behind this legislation was to ensure that the people who were creating these works were paid what they were worth. That was the whole idea. Supposedly, that was the whole idea. But instead, what it seemed to focus heavily on was to jack up the amount of money that people would get paid who owned the originals of songs, of movies, who were copyright owners to all of this stuff. Now, you might say, well, that, you know, that's not necessarily bad, or that's not bad. That's, you know, you got to make sure people get compensated. Well, yeah, but the majority of the time, the people who you're compensating had nothing to do with the production of whatever they're getting compensated for. They were able to buy these things because they had a lot of money, and they usually had a lot of money because of institutional racism and enslavement, especially when you're talking music. And so the argument, where it seems fair, isn't. Not only, you know, and I'm a person who believes that, especially if you're talented, man, you should be getting compensated what you are worth. Yes. But not at the expense of innovation and growth. I heard about this occurring on a documentary about Public Enemy. Chuck D actually mentioned it. I've mentioned this again before for you guys. I went trying to find it. It wasn't until a couple of years later, and by a couple of years later, I mean like a decade later, because I remembered it. I found it online and was like, oh, okay, okay. He described it as essentially making illegal, or making illegal by making it too expensive, the way that they made music. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard Public Enemy, especially their early albums, but their early albums used a lot of samples. A lot of samples. Now, for those of you who don't know, in the music industry, a sample is a piece from another song that is repurposed in another, usually a song. So I would say in another work of art, but it's usually in another song. What Public Enemy did was what a lot of street DJs did. And by street DJs, I'm not talking about people who are out on the street, but folks who are unaffiliated with any of the big, you know, big business, big music business groups or anything like that. These were folks who were just spinning discs and making a name for themselves at parties. And what these people would do is they would put a lot of, not a ton, but really good sound effects, including sound effects that they would grab from television and movies and commercials and all these other things. They would take bits of songs and make sound effects, and they would create these works of rhythmic masterpiece art on the fly. And that's how they got their names, was, man, they could do this amazing work in real time, and it's just fantastic. Public Enemy took what they were doing and put it into a mainstream rap album. And if you listen to the early album that they put out, it is fascinating to hear how many different sounds they could jam into a song. It was phenomenal. This was on top of, so their work was probably, one of those studied in order to write this new legislation. And to be fair, there was a group of people in Congress at the time who were anti-hip-hop. They were very anti-hip-hop. But there were other people who were using samples from songs, and in their use of these samples, they would usually use 3, 4, 5, sometimes 6 or 7 samples from different songs, and then they would make something new from them. A whole new song, a whole new compilation, composition, a new composition, and that would produce, you know, something unique. And by the way, just for those of you who don't know, who confuse hip-hop today with hip-hop back then, no. One of the rules of hip-hop was innovation and uniqueness. You had to do that. There was a cultural uniqueness and innovation that went with it. With this new law, what it essentially did, and by essentially, I mean it did it well, was it made it impossible for hip-hop to innovate, because hip-hop was always taking from the past to create the future. That was the goal. It was taking from the past to create the future. Now, it was creating new things along the way, and for those of you who like hip-hop, especially from the early 90s, you could see how they would take these old sounds and craft something new. By making it damn near impossible to do that, because of how they were doing it, you know, 4, 5, 6 samples at a time, and Public Enemy were taking literally a dozen plus samples at a time in a song, by making it impossible for them to do that because it was too expensive, what you saw nearly immediately, and it did take a couple of years for it to really sink in, was music became blander. Music became blander. This jumped out at me in early 1994 when I was listening to some of the songs, and I was like, man, this is still sounding decent, but there's something off with it. Like the group All for One, I think was their name. The song I Swear. Very 90s sound, very kind of early 90s, a little bit of the 80s sound, but for it coming out in the early 90s, it was a little, you know. Well, actually, no. Let me take that back. No. Let me take that back. A better example would have not been in 1994. Would have been in, I think it was either late 94 or early 95. Brandy's I Want to Be Down. Brandy's I Want to Be Down. Shaggy's Boombastic. This was the type of sampling that was left over from this new law. Whereas if you look at from like 90 to 93 and still a little bit in early 94, a lot of the sampling was more layered. It was more complex. You had to really listen to understand the samples that you were hearing in real time. Whereas the samples post 94, they were always one song samples. Always one song samples. So Mariah Carey's Fantasy is a great example of what that legislation created. You started seeing songs that were more written for an instrumental that had been previously created. And there'd be maybe a couple of things added and tweaked to it. And then a person would sing over it like it was a new song. So it was hard to see it when it was happening, that transition when it was happening. But really by 2005, the impact of that legislation was clear. It had handcuffed the innovative spirit that was coming from being able to take all of these different sounds and utilize them in new projects. And I will tell you, the reason music is in the state that it is today is not only because of the Telecommunication Act, but it's also because of that act from the early 1990s. This is what intellectual property rights do. It handcuffs innovation. Handcuffs innovation and stops human nature, which is always to look to the past to build the present and to build the future. It stops humanity from being able to do that. Now, I understand if some of you are skeptical, but as I've often said, think about what I've laid out here. There are so many of you who are in your 40s now, who are in your 50s, who are like, what happened to music? Why is music so different now? Music is so different now because it literally has, it has been allowed to devolve because it was stopped from evolving. And we don't recognize that because oftentimes when laws go into effect, we don't think about the consequences of those laws. We don't think about how society evolves based on those laws. Typically, we think about it after a long period of time. Hence, you know, it's been 30 years since that piece of legislation was passed. Well, it was a mistake. It was wrong. Intellectual property rights, at the end of the day, is about the use of intellectual property rights is typically about the wealthy trying to stop other people who can do something better than they can from profiting off of their skill and making themselves wealthy off of that skill. That is what intellectual property rights are typically on. A much broader way of looking at this, especially from a historic sense, is as soon as Europeans went across the world and found something that they could utilize that would make it possible for them to rule over a group of people, they did that thing, and then, you know, 20 years later, a generation later, they would make that thing illegal for everyone else to do but themselves, because they could profit off of it. So everything that is profitable for them, they want to stop you from doing because they know you can do it well. And by the way, this is one of the things, hate China if you want, but this is one of the things China has said repeatedly over the last 30 years. They have looked at the United States, who cries, you're ripping off our intellectual property. You're ripping off our intellectual property. China has looked at the history. I've read articles literally where they have talked about this, where people, should I say, from China have talked about this. They've looked at the history of the United States and said, wait a minute, you want to talk about ripping off people's intellectual property? Let's start here, and how much intellectual property did you take to get to where you at? Yeah, we ain't listening to you. The rest of the world does it because they want to seem moralistic. China's like, nah, we're out for this power. Have a good day, y'all. You can scream and moan and complain all you want, but we out for this power, and you know it, and that's why you hate us. That's why you hate us. That ain't me sticking up for China. That's just me telling you to deal with what they're thinking. In conclusion, intellectual property rights should not limit innovation. Neither should copyright law. If it's going to be a real thing, it got to work on behalf of promoting innovation. If you like the work that I'm doing here, y'all, support me and support Class War Battlefield Podcast. As I said many times before and at the beginning of the show, actually, I don't even know if I say it at the beginning of the show. Depends on which intro I use. CWB Podcast. You can hit me up on Cash App. You can hit me up on PayPal. If you like the work I'm doing, please support me, guys. Trying to keep this thing going. All right. Thanks for joining me. I'm sorry. I'm running out of space. That's why I'm fumbling a little bit today, because I'm running out of space of recording this. I don't do this on a computer because I like the sound of this. So I do it on a handheld thing, and it's running out of space. Either way, thanks guys for joining me today. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know you can always reach out to me. I love hearing from you guys. I am your brother, Brian Meredith Ogaya, and I will see you on the next one.
There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and there are lies in the balance.